The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984.
The World of Islam, Part 5, The Magnificent Heritage, The Golden Age of Islamic Civilization. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
Much of today's world is strongly influenced by Western ideas and values, in short, by Western civilization and culture. However, we in the West draw much of our intellectual and cultural heritage from a once mighty Islamic civilization. Between the 7th and 15th centuries, this Islamic civilization dominated the intellectual and cultural forms and values of much of the then known world, from Spain to India, from Sicily to Samarkand. The West is largely ignorant of this magnificent Islamic civilization and our indebtedness to it. But as we shall discover in this program, Islamic civilization was and is much more than the mosque or the arabesque. The program is reported and narrated by Julian Crandall Hollick.
Islamic civilization, perhaps more accurately the civilization of the Muslims, had two essential characteristics. The first, according to Laila A. Ibrahim in Cairo, Egypt, was a high degree of flexibility.
When the Arabs, they conquered the Middle East, Egypt, North Africa, to Spain, and to the east up to the borders of China, of course they have came into contact with different cultures, and they have taken, adopted, and also they have given a great deal to these countries and to these cultures.
Islam, therefore, came as an overlay to existing cultural forms and traditions and combined them into a larger Islamic culture. The result was extraordinary diversity of local cultures, yet all integrated and defined by Islam. The second characteristic comes from Islam itself. Nasir David Khalili is a Jew born and raised in Iran and an expert on Islamic art.
There is always the element of religion attached to any type of Islamic art, from calligraphy to pottery making to metalwork to painting to making fabrics. Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter what part of Islamic art you talk about. You always attach an element of religion to it.
The presence of Islam may not be immediately obvious to the Western observer, but it is always there.
There is no literature, there is no art, which is not an externalization of what one has absorbed, what one has taken deep into the blood, into thinking, into feelings, into emotions.
Anis Ahmed is an Islamic scholar and activist in Islamabad, Pakistan.
And the source, definitely, for this Islamic literature is the Quran and Al-Hadith, which means the Quran acted as the agent which transformed thinking process of an artist. If one wanted to write about love and beauty, there are many ways of conveying that a rose is beautiful. But when a poet relates the beauty of rose with his internal feelings which he has drawn from the Quran, we find a relationship between his belief and literature.
In Western culture, art forms tend to have separate and individual identities of their own. Literature is clearly different from either painting or sculpture. However, these distinctions are much more blurred in Islamic culture. One finds an art form such as calligraphy used in many other formats. Malikian Shivani is an Iranian art expert now living in France.
You do not have, in that part of the world, the barriers separating different artistic categories in the sense that you have them in the West. You do not have architecture without calligraphy. You do not have books without calligraphy. A book is always a calligraphed work. And you do not have objet d'art without calligraphy, which often creates an interplay between the shape, the images that are represented on the object, and the mental images which are played with in the poetry itself. It's a different world.
Islamic visual art forms are usually described as dominated by the abstract, as opposed to Western art, which delights in reproducing nature and human beings. While there is a general absence of visual art forms in Arabia itself, largely the result of Bedouin indifference to art, it is widely believed that figurative art is not permitted in Islam. Anis Ahmed again.
First of all, the Quran condemns figurative art.
That is absolutely untrue. I mean, it certainly is not true in the Iranian world, as you surely know, but it's not true in the Arab world either.
The roots of the argument here presented by Malikian Shivani go back to the cleansing of the Kaaba, or House of God, in Mecca by Muhammad. It is known that the Prophet ordered all idols in the Kaaba to be destroyed. For many Muslims, any figurative likeness, whether in a painting or a sculpture, would therefore constitute an idol. But, says Malikian Shivani, Muhammad made one significant exception.
He spread his arm over what seems to have been a pillar, presumably with a fresco painting, which we know represented the Virgin Mary, a very holy figure to Muslims, as she is to Christians, although for different reasons, as the mother of a much revered prophet, Jesus, and said, erase them all with the exception of that one.
Unfortunately, the fresco is believed to have been destroyed in a fire soon afterwards. There are also several hadith which can be interpreted to mean a ban on figurative painting. For Ahmed Mustafa, an Egyptian artist, there are clear limits.
The dispute, as far as I am concerned, is not representing any figurative art in any religious theme, i.e. representing the Prophet, his successors, God.
While many Muslims continue to believe that Muhammad cannot be represented, Malikian Shivani maintains that the ban applies only to God.
God cannot be represented, if only because he cannot be conceived in his entirety.
Why can Muhammad not be represented?
Muhammad can be represented and has often been represented in various manuscripts.
And of course, Persian and Indian miniature paintings are full of scenes from nature and life. The Persianate miniature is one of the most exquisite of all visual art forms, extravagant in its choice of subject matter and its uninhibited depiction of the most intimate of human activities. It is clear, therefore, that parts of the Islamic world outside the Arab Middle East do not observe a ban on figurative painting. But it is also true that the visual arts of the whole Islamic world are generally characterized by the abstract, as Anis Ahmed explains.
When you are not permitted to make an image, then you have to create things from abstract thinking, yet they have to have a manifest form. And that's where Muslim art has made its great contribution. Not in simply things which we can touch and feel, and we can say how a beautiful replica it is of nature, but in things which are not replica, rather real creation. That's why word, calligraphy, is the highest kind of art which we find in Islamic tradition.
The word, spoken or written, therefore takes the place of the recreation or imitation of life.
The Muslim artist, after the revelation in Islam, find himself in a situation he had to find another medium to represent his talent. The only medium for him was calligraphy.
The Arabic language is sacred to Muslims because it is the language in which God chose to reveal his final message in the Quran. There is thus a powerful relationship between the script and its spiritual content. And this may help explain why calligraphy, the art of ornamentation of the written word, is so important to Muslim artists. Why educated Arabs used to feel as much pride in the beauty of handwriting as in the degree of their knowledge. Why the arts of illumination and bookmaking were so important and advanced in the Islamic world, and why calligraphy in its various patterns and scripts is, with architecture, the most important of art forms in Islamic culture. You can find calligraphy almost everywhere, on sculpture, metalwork, in paintings, on architecture and pottery. The most original form of pottery was lustreware, found from Spain to Persia. Lustreware was characterized by sumptuous surfaces produced by a complex and costly process known as double firing. It would be covered with intricate patterns in gorgeous colors, usually with a word or verse from the Quran incorporated into the overall design. Prose and poetry were often indistinguishable. Poetry was probably the major form of written and oral expression.
It was chanted to the accompaniment of instruments such as the lute and the harp.
Malikian Shivani is here talking about the Persian art of the book of the early Middle Ages.
The odes of the Persian poet Hafez, a famous 14th century poet, were always sung, and it's a whole. That is extremely important, and it's all the more important as poetry is not an ornament, not a literary ornament. It's a whole way of life. It's a literature of themes and motifs, not an evocative literature of the Western Romantic type. And it's loaded with metaphysical teachings and mystical teachings. It has molded the entire Persian mind, and further than that, the minds of the two main areas which came under very strong Iranian influence, however some of them may have felt antagonistic towards it, Turkey on the one hand, and Islamic India, which I would call Hindustan, on the other hand. Whoever came under the influence of Persian poetry has had his mind molded more strongly than it would be by any other spiritual teaching, I would say, and it leaves an indelible mark on whoever has had his mind influenced by it.
Persian influences were very powerful, particularly in Turkey and the Indian subcontinent, where the Urdu script is very similar to the Persian Farsi. But the common language of this civilization was Arabic. Here is an ataba, a typical Arabic poem from Syria. The sung poetry of the Islamic world, highly stylized and full of sensual imagery, entered medieval Europe via Spain. Musical styles and instruments such as the oud or lute were incorporated into the literature and songs of courtly love of the troubadours, along with the romantic imagery of Islamic poetry. The most lasting and visible legacy of the great Muslim civilization is probably architecture. Once again, Laila Ibrahim in Cairo.
Of course, the main concepts behind architecture are more or less the same in all the Islamic countries. There is a unity in Islamic culture all over the world. But we have, at the same time, a different, I would say, style, a character, particular to each Islamic country.
While specific features such as the column, the arch, or the dome predate Islam, the influence of the new religion was nonetheless profound, if subtle. Ahmed Bakari is an architect in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia.
So man created a space where there is so much repetition of one element, which is the column and the arch, to give the feeling that this space is infinite. This space has no end and no beginning. And this is really what Islamic architecture is all about. It's about space.
Even the design of the mosque varied greatly from country to country. Only the minaret was common from Spain to Indonesia. The first mosque, that of Muhammad, was extremely simple in form, as here described by Lala Ibrahim.
The mosque evolved gradually, because the very first mosque, that of Medina, the Prophet's mosque, it was, to begin with, merely an enclosure. Then in summer, they put up palm tree trunks and covered these with palm trees, and they prayed in the mosque in summer.
Many of the great buildings of Islam are still standing. In India, the Mughal dynasty built the Taj Mahal. In neighboring Pakistan, one can still marvel at the size of the central courtyard of the Badshahi Mosque in Lahore. In Isfahan, one can visit the beautiful mosque of Ibn Tulun. In Spain, the great mosque at Cordoba reminds us of the glories of Spain's Islamic heritage. The Mosque of Suleiman the Magnificent in Istanbul offers a fine example of the various functions combined in a mosque. You can find within its area a hospital, a hotel for visitors, a school, a technical workshop, a water distribution station, public baths, an institute for advanced religious legal studies, and naturally Suleiman's tomb. A society is not to be judged by artistic creation alone. We can still see these wonderful and extravagant examples of Islamic art today. But what we cannot see and have forgotten are the wealth and invention of ideas that sprang from the golden age of Islamic civilization between the 7th and 15th centuries. There is still in the West a popular belief that Islam is basically hostile to scientific progress. Physics professor Abdus Salam, the first Muslim to win a Nobel Prize, emphatically rejects the idea.
Good heavens, good heavens. Here is a new community which started with a book, and immediately afterwards it gave rise to all the sciences, which it accepted the scientific approach. So to say that Islam has been anti-science is just so ridiculous that I have no other phrase for it.
According to Abdus Salam, Islam in fact encourages scientific inquiry.
There are these two key concepts in the Holy Book. The idea of tafkir, which means the Muslim community making a deep study of nature and thereby recognize Allah and His creations. And the second concept is that of taskhir, the acquiring of mastery over nature.
One of the great historians of science, George Sarton, classified eras according to their outstanding scientists or thinkers. Between the years 750 and 1100, world science was exclusively dominated by Muslims, men such as Khwarizmi.
This man Khwarizmi, the second man on Sarton's list, is the man who invents algebra, who brings the numerals, they were Hindu numerals, imported from India, but he makes a whole calculus of them. And imagine what mathematics would be like without those numerals. What could we have done without those numerals? Suppose you were still busy with the Roman characters. goodness knows what would have happened. All the progress in mathematics is due to these two concepts. Algebra, entirely his own invention.
There were many other great thinkers, such as Biruni, who developed the science of trigonometry, or his contemporary Ibn al-Haytham, who created the modern science of optics. Islamic medical knowledge and training were also far in advance of Western Europe. By the 12th century, Muslims had standardized medical training. Mental illness was treated as a curable disease. Contagious sicknesses were isolated, and disease was studied under controlled laboratory conditions. The great pioneer was Ibn Sina, better known in Europe as Avicenna. Ibn Sina was born in the 11th century in what is now Soviet Central Asia. His medical encyclopedia served as the standard medical textbook in European hospitals up until the 18th century. The need to determine the direction and times for prayer and the requirements of the other pillars of Islam spurred Muslim astronomers to improve and develop instruments such as the astrolabe, the quadrant, and navigational charts. Without these maps, the great European voyages of discovery might have been delayed hundreds of years. Abdus Salam again.
Now, if the tradition of these people had carried on as it had started, natural sciences would have been more advanced today than they are today.
In geography and history, the major names were Al-Idrisi and Ibn Khaldun. We've also forgotten the great schools of Islamic philosophy represented by men such as Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, Averroes, Al-Ghazali, Nasiruddin Tusi, or Sarardin Shirazi. The heyday of Islamic philosophy took place between the 8th and 14th centuries, although a rich philosophical tradition continued under the Safavids in Persia up into the 18th century. In the main centers of Islamic learning, especially Spain and Sicily, Iraq and Syria, major works of classical Greek philosophy were translated into Arabic by Jewish and Christian scholars. Out of it all emerged an original and distinctive Islamic philosophy needed to resolve contradictions and convert doubters to Islam.
So they realized the need for something beyond the Quran and the prophetic sayings in their effort to convince their opponents.
Hamid Enayat is an Iranian scholar.
And their philosophy became very important. They realized that they have to use rational argument in order to silence their opponents.
In the West, we take for granted the Greek philosophical heritage as the basis of the European Renaissance. But without the Muslims, this would have been lost.
There's no doubt that it was thanks to Muslims that Greek works were later translated into Latin, and the Greek heritage passed to the West. So Muslims can talk very proudly of that contribution. The very fact that they preserved the bulk of the Greek heritage by translating those works into Arabic, preventing them from being destroyed or forgotten, and later on, this heritage, as I said, was inherited by the West.
Why did this vibrant civilization decline to the point where the West knows little or nothing of it?
There is a class of people who think that this was the external causes, like the invasion of the Mongols. There is no question that that played a very big role in the destruction of scholars and libraries. Don't forget that in those days, before printing was known, once a library is gone, a man's whole life is gone. If his works are unknown after that, that's the end of it.
For Abdus Salam, there was a more important cause for the decline.
Personally, I feel that this was not the major reason. I think the influence of the ulama, the religious divines, played a fairly strong part in making the Muslim community turn inwards. There was a feeling that this vast assimilation of sciences was leading to an anti-religious feeling, and that they had to be suppressed.
The concept of independent thinking, known as ijtihad, which had led to many of the great discoveries and advances of Islamic civilization, was severely restricted by the ulama. Gradually, it was replaced by taqlid, or obedience to previous teachings.
The gates of ijtihad were closed by ulama for various reasons. I think one of the basic ones, that they feared that in the name of ijtihad, people who were not qualified for ijtihad introduced innovations in religion which weren't quite correct.
Ziauddin Saada is a young Pakistani writer on Islam and science.
So ijtihad virtually died down, and taqlid became the dominant concept of Muslim society. First of all, it simply meant following religious rulings, classical Muslim scholars, the four imams. But because taqlid is an all-pervasive concept, it introduced sort of blind following in other areas.
As an historian, you can see the line going up, up, up until the 14th century. Then it reaches a sort of apex, and then inexorably it starts going down. You know, by the time you have reached the late 15th century, that something is doomed. It still remains quite remarkable for a long time, but you can see it going down. As it went down much faster in the countries that were weaker, in the Arab world, it went down. It was at level zero by the 17th century. Nothing was made of any interest in any Arab country from the 17th century onwards. In Iran, it lived a little longer.
Islamic civilization lost much of its energy, although it continued to bring forth many remarkable cultural and scientific achievements right up to the 20th century. For Nobel laureate Abdus Salam, the breakdown of the dialogue between West and East was the real tragedy.
Sciences started to be created in the West, and we in Islam distanced ourselves from it. It was imperative that we, in our interest, should have kept contact with it. We did not. And slowly, what was much worse was that the tradition was lost.
The Magnificent Heritage was written and produced by Julian Crandall Hollick. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the rebroadcast producer was Dean Capello. The music consultant was Brian Silver of International Music Associates. Consultants to this program were Professors Oleg Grabar of Harvard University and the late Hamid Enayat of Oxford University, to whose memory this program is dedicated. The World of Islam is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, in cooperation with WBUR Boston, and is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Schilling. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.